Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinarily unequivocal and damning report from the US intelligence community outlining the scope and extent of Russian meddling in our recent election, directed by Vladimir Putin and aimed at hurting Hillary Clinton and helping elect Donald Trump. David Satter, a fellow of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin, joins us to discuss what possible hidden ties exist between Trump and Putin, given the president-elect's contorted apologies for Putin's actions and his disparagement of America's intelligence services findings that were just made public. We will also examine Putin's possible motives and whether Trump and his nominee for Secretary of State will be able to implement their plans to get along better with Russia. Then we'll go to Moscow and speak with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent defense analyst, columnist, and journalist with the Novaya Gazeta, one of the few independent non-government media outlets left in Putin's Russia. He joins us to discuss why Russia's military intelligence, the GRU, were used by Putin and what the local reaction is to the U.S. intelligence report on the part of government officials and ordinary citizens. And then finally, we will speak with Christine Fair, an expert on Pakistan and Afghanistan, who is a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program. She is under attack by right-wing supporters of Donald Trump, who, along with a Muslim woman who wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, "I'm a Muslim, a woman, and an immigrant. I voted for Trump," are pressuring Georgetown University authorities to have Chris Fair fired. And joining us now is David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades. He is a fellow of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his previous books, all published by Yale University Press, include Darkness at Dawn. And his latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Satter.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, do you agree with my opening remarks, David, that this intelligence report is pretty extraordinary, I think unprecedented, with a president about president-elect about to be inaugurated, his very legitimacy is being questioned and brought into question. And curiously enough, according to Sunday's New York Times, there are many of Trump's supporters don't think this is a big deal. But I think in the overall schemes of things, the idea that a hostile foreign power would interfere in America's elections, not that we haven't interfered in other people's elections for decades, is a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal. I mean, I don't know about us not interfering in other people's elections. We interfered in the, or at least Americans interfered in the 1996 elections in Russia and provided all kinds of support to Yeltsin in his contest with the communists. But I think that what's extraordinary here in the situation that we have right now is the way in which Trump is disparaging the intelligence community. As president, he's going to be vitally dependent on them to give him an accurate picture of the world and to guide his decisions. And I don't think that it's in his interest or in theirs, and certainly not in the interest of the country, for him to be doing this. I think that what's taking place is a reflection of the hyper-politicized atmosphere in the country. My feeling about it is that the reason that Trump is making these remarks, which are absolutely unacceptable, is because he fears, not because he necessarily thinks that the American intelligence community is incompetent. I don't think he thinks that, and in fact, he would be wrong if he did think that. What's motivating him, I think, is a desire to preserve the legitimacy of his election. He sees this as a threat to his ability to rule, to run the country in the future. And he's reacting in a manner that's inappropriate, but I don't think it's a reflection of his desire to go to war with the intelligence community. If the intelligence community had made findings. On the contrary, that the Russians had been mounting a campaign to elect Hillary Clinton and to sabotage his campaign, I'm sure he would have considered them absolutely brilliant. So if the, once this issue subsides, if it subsides, it may be possible and it's certainly desirable for Trump to establish a more appropriate relationship with the people who help keep us safe.
Well, do you think, though, that Trump's behavior in doubling down consistently, and even now after this report has been made public, and frankly, it is pretty unequivocal and quite damning, and presumably the other information that buttressed it that is still classified is even more convincing, although a lot of people still, for the life of me, I don't understand. They still say that, where's the proof, where's the proof? And Trump's defense is that it didn't make any difference. Well, it's impossible to know what made a difference here with the FBI letter, with Hillary Clinton's appallingly bad campaign. There's a whole bunch of reasons, and the use of Facebook on the part of Stephen Bannon. There's a whole bunch of reasons why Trump won narrowly. But it's hard to divorce that from Russian meddling. You just can't quantify these things. But my sense of Trump is that his MO as a hard-nosed businessman is to double down on anybody who attacks him. It's almost like a reflex.
It certainly looks that way.
Yeah.
It looks as if he doesn't want to see the evidence, doesn't want to consider it. I mean, obviously the thing for him to do in this situation is to say, if there's evidence that a foreign power has tried to interfere in the election, then we need to get that. We need to get the facts out, and the American people need a clear picture. He hasn't taken that position, and I think this reflects more than anything else his personality. But I don't think that what we're seeing is necessarily his desire to go to war with the intelligence community. I think he's defending himself against the implication that he wasn't elected legitimately. I think that's what's happening.
So, well, what about, though, in the defense, the New York Times on Sunday's edition front page stories, lots of Trump supporters are basically saying this is no big deal, you know, and they're going along with the idea that it's all sour grapes on the part of the Democrats. There is a phenomenon here that I find extraordinary, and that is that nationalists, and there's no question that Donald Trump ran in a kind of a nationalist campaign, that nationalists hate enemies in their countries more than they hate enemies of their countries.
Well, we're talking at a very high level of generality here.
Right.
I
do that sometimes.
The one thing, I think that what's happened in the United States is that there's been a big cultural change signaled by this election. We had we've had identity politics in the U.S. for a long time. Groups that were disenfranchised were able to recover their positions. We established some type of codes of political correctness, which had the effect of protecting people from abuse, for the most part. But it was inevitable that when the white working class began to feel that its situation was getting worse and worse, that they too would become an identity group. And I think that those were the people who elected Trump and who are now trying to asserting themselves. And they're asserting themselves in both appropriate and inappropriate ways, but the result is that the whole atmosphere in the country has become politicized. And it's very difficult for us to look at anything, whether it's the Russian hacking relations with any of the issues that have been raised objectively. An objective look at the Russian hacking, I think, would not so much come to the conclusion that there's some Russian conspiracy to elect Trump. I think that what was at stake was what we're dealing with here is a Russian conspiracy to discredit America and to discredit the American electoral process in the eyes of Russians. What we often don't get is the fact that Russians are more concerned about their own country than they are about us. I mean, they're concerned about us, of course. But the real challenge that the Trump versus Clinton election presented from a Russian point of view is that it showed it's possible to have a competitive election in which the results are not known in advance, and Russians aren't accustomed to that. So that had to be discredited. The process, you know, the whole hacking operation began long before Trump appeared to be a viable candidate. And even when the first WikiLeaks revelations were released, or the first emails were released, Hillary seemed to be an overwhelming favorite. And therefore, if the goal was to elect Trump, it didn't really make a lot of sense, because all that they would succeed in doing was alienating Hillary. But if the goal was to discredit the American political system in the eyes of Russians, then it made perfect sense, because the message that the Russians wanted to convey was, well, sure, we're corrupt here in Russia, but they're just as bad in America.
Well, I think, though, and this is one of the reasons I called you, David Satter. You see, you've written about Russia for almost four decades, your latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. Is that, you know, in making excuses for Putin, as a lot of people on the American left and on the American right are doing, along with Donald Trump himself, you have to really understand that Putin is a different kind of world leader. He came to power by killing, I think, about 183 of his own fellow citizens.
It's about 300.
I
mean, it's interesting that you say that, and that you understand that is, I mean, that's something that I personally have had a hard time getting people to understand, that they came to power through an act of terror, and our government has not accepted that, and neither did the Obama administration, by the way, when they ignored that reality when they launched the reset policy, right. Which, I mean.
Well, it's not just that they blew up all those apartment buildings on the outskirts of Russia, and it's that the people that investigated, many of whom were ex-KGB, were all just about, all of them were either exiled or murdered, and the last of whom was Litvinenko, who was poisoned with polonium, that had inside knowledge. So it's not just that they murdered their own citizens, but they ruthlessly covered it up and prosecuted a war in Chechnya. And there's nothing like a good war to make you popular.
Well, that's exactly how Putin came to power, and I'm glad to hear that you understand that, and because this is something that a lot of people don't want to face, and certainly Trump does not want to face it, and he needs to face it if he's going to have any kind of reasonable policy toward Russia. But also, Hillary Clinton didn't want, she was a proponent of the reset policy, and that took place, a short time after the murder of Alexander Litvinenko in London, at a time when it was clear that the Russian authorities were involved. So what I'm saying is that although Trump is radically uninformed when it comes to Russia, it's not as if the other side was well informed. I mean, we've got a problem with understanding Russia in both parties, and as for the motives of the Russians themselves, their motive is not to choose between two candidates, both of whom are not very well informed, and both of whom they think they can manipulate, but rather to convince Russian people that the American elections are a fraud and that what they think they're seeing is not reality, that actually behind the scenes everything is manipulated. That's the most important message that they tried to get across with these leaks. And Trump would do himself and the country a big favor if he stopped fighting against the obvious and accepted the opinion of the intelligence community and took serious steps to find out, to provide the details to the American people of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, David Satter, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And again, I mean, speaking with David Satter, who's written about Russia for almost four decades. He is a fellow of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. Now, we're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Moscow to speak with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer. I recorded this interview just before we went on the air, and it's just as well that I did because the authorities kept cutting off the interview. We had to call him back on any number of occasions to finally get the full interview. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. His regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Thank you.
And if there's a general reaction, I'm sure there's a variety of reactions in Russia, both from the official Kremlin spokespeople, from the president's spokespeople, and et cetera. And I'd like to be able to get a sense of how the Russian people are reacting to this extraordinary report from the U.S. intelligence community published at the end of last week with the following briefings of President-elect Trump by the heads of the major U.S. intelligence agencies. One of the extraordinary reactions here in the United States has been from Trump supporters and people who voted for him who think it's no big deal that Russia, directed by Vladimir Putin, meddled in our elections. What are you hearing in Moscow?
Well, there's a difference between Russia and the U.S. and the West in general. The Russian Orthodox Christmas has happened only a day ago, so the first week of January is a totally non-working week. It's a holiday. So that means that the reactions were rather muted, because people were out, either out of town or abroad or somewhere. At least there's no business happening here. There are no newspapers published here. Political programming on TV is also rather, thin. So the reactions were not very much vocal and sort of muted. The official line is that this is all, there's no clear evidence that this Russia didn't have anything to do with it, and that this is a kind of a Obama administration, sour grapes going out and accusing everyone of their failures, and the Democrats accusing Russia for losing the presidential elections in November. And so there, yes, of course, there's a clear kind of line of mutual sort of sounding arguments between the Russian officialdom and the supporters of Donald Trump.
So is there a sense, as reports came in earlier, when Trump got elected, and apparently some of the evidence that was presented to Donald Trump on Friday by the intelligence, U.S. intelligence, included intercepts of senior Russian officials celebrating Trump's election. I understand that the local media has been very pro-Trump, that both before and after the election, and that in general, people are happy. I imagine in a very simple sense, Russians must be happy that they have a candidate about to become president who wants to get along better with Russia.
Well, the official propaganda line by the Russian agitprop was, yes, Trump is good, Hillary is bad, and that we would want Trump, and that if he's elected, then many problems will go away, sanctions will be removed, Russian athletes will not be punished for using the dope. I mean, everything's going to be kind of turned from black to white. There is in the Russian elite a kind of dream of a second Yalta, like the Yalta conference of the big three in early 1945, that we'll get together and with the leaders of Russia and America and divide, or maybe with also some French or German, especially if they're having elections in those countries, kind of more isolationist nationalist forces come to power, that we get together, we'll put a map on the table, and we'll carve up the Europe and maybe the world into spheres of influence like in Yalta 45. I don't really believe that's going to happen, but that dream is here. And many people here ask me, well, Trump was elected. Will there be this kind of deal or maybe not? Trump will not be allowed by the American establishment to become a real Russian ally.
And when you talk about the elite, my understanding from this intelligence report here in the United States that it was the GRU that has been accused for doing these hackings, and was in fact that Vladimir Putin ordered the GRU to hack into Hillary Clinton and her campaign manager and the DNC, etc. I've also heard reports, and I'd be interested in getting your opinions on this, that within the FSB and the SVR, the other intelligence services, that there was some dissent about the extent of the reckless nature of meddling in the U.S. elections. Is there a connection there with the resignation or the firing of Vladimir Putin's ex-KGB colleague Ivanov, who is his chief of staff and the head of the presidential ministry, who was fired and replaced by a younger person? Was that indicative of, in any way, dissent within?
I don't think that the retirement of Ivanov, Sergei Ivanov, is connected to the American elections that happened before, and it's not connected. I don't believe that story. The GRU, if of course, I don't know for sure, I didn't see the closed version, the classified version of this report, which has most likely the details which could really be real evidence of Russian meddling. The non-classified report does not have much, of course, in the sphere of evidence, but most likely because this is sensitive stuff. If you you shouldn't really do and explain to adversaries your capabilities to kind of look into what's happening. So we'll have to guess. I don't know, was Russia really involved or not, but GRU, yes, that makes sense, because the GRU is in charge of kind of eavesdropping traditionally and in kind of electronic gathering of information and most likely hacking. So that's their domain, not the domain of the former KGB, now Sweden, now FSB or SVR. That's traditionally the domain of the GRU, of military intelligence. Like the American National Security Agency, which is also a kind of militarized organization. So yes, of course, if it was done by Russia, or Russian sources, Russian assets were involved, it would be the GRU. That makes sense.
So there's a lot of speculation, Dr. Felgenauer, over here in the United States about why it is that Donald Trump goes out of his way to make excuses for Vladimir Putin. And in the face of this damning intelligence report, he still seems to, he's even blaming the Democratic National Committee for not securing their data, blaming the victim in effect. So he goes through all kinds of contortions to not to be in any way critical of Vladimir Putin, and he's, and in his most recent tweets has said that people have to be stupid not to want to have better relations with Russia, which on the surface makes sense. Do you have any idea of what the nature, what ties there are between these two men that would... One of the speculations that I have heard is that the head of Exxon, soon to be Secretary of State, assuming he passes the confirmation, he already had big plans with Rosneft to develop Siberian and Arctic oil and gas. Is there a big oil play underway here where Russia could develop its gas, oil and gas in Siberia and pipe it into the Asian markets and make the Asian markets dependent upon Russia in the way that Western Europe is dependent upon Gazprom? Is there a big strategic play underway here? The reverse of Nixon's 1972 strategy where the U.S. and China allied against Russia? Is there any possibility under Trump and Putin of an alliance between the U.S. and Russia in a sense to contain China? Are you there? Did we lose him? We must have lost him.
Hello?
Oh, hi. I just lost you there when I was asking you whether...
Oh, the line was cut. Maybe you were saying something really sensitive. Good for us.
Yeah, well, that's possibly the case. Let me pick up on that last question about, do you think there's a big strategic play underway here where you could have a reverse of Nixon's 1972 strategy of the U.S. and China relying against Russia, in this case Russia and the U.S. lying against China in a big oil deal?
Well, attempts maybe to persuade Russia to align with the U.S. against China. Well, that's a theme that has been kind of sounded in Washington, but I don't believe it's going to be really practical right now. Ties between Russia and China are too important. They are. In some cases, there's no real alternative. That's what I have been telling to Japanese, that your attempt kind of to woo Russia away from China. Well, it's interesting, but I don't think right now it's going to really work. About the deals that ExxonMobil had with Rosneft, well, they are interesting deals at a time when oil was more than $100, much more than $100 a barrel. Right now, it doesn't make much sense to try and develop the oil deposits in the Arctic Sea off Novaya Zemlya. It will be just too expensive at the present selling rate. And I believe these contracts will be put on hold no matter what. They're just simply right now economically, financially senseless.
So you don't
say... these were the contracts that the chief of Exxon was developing with Mr. Sechin. I don't think right now they have much sense. I mean, even if sanctions are removed, I don't see a lot of prospect of them being going online anytime.
So you don't see it being drill, baby, drill on both sides. Did we lose him again? Just keep calling it, okay? Okay. We got cut again. Yeah. But let me just ask you, just obviously want to make the best use of the time as long as the lines are not cut. What is Putin's plans to revive the Russian economy?
Well, Putin doesn't have plans. Putin is the czar. Mm-hmm. He is the arbiter in chief. He's presented with different options. Some of the options are kind of presented by the liberal faction, quote-unquote, of the government, led by former finance minister and deputy prime minister and Putin's big personal friend, Alexei Kudrin, who says that we should deregulate, that we should cut defense spending dramatically, that we should end confrontation with the West, that we should disband these state corporations like Gazprom, Rosneft, and others, and then we're going to have sustainable economic growth. And I also say that, no, we should kind of go more Soviet and print money, invest it into developing the so-called real sector, the defense industry, and in general any kind of industry, build up protectionist walls, and so that our industry will develop and flourish. And Putin is kind of trying to figure out who he's going to rely on more. So there's different, that's very important because there are different factions. So if we indeed have a real detente with America, a bromance between, really happening between Putin and Trump, that means that the Kudrin fraction, right now he's not in office, but he still meets Putin on a regular basis, and he's supported by the finance minister, by the chief of central bank. He is still an important figure. And so his fraction gets the upper hand, which is bad for the defense industry, for the generals, for military-industrial complex in general, and for the state monopolies, these state corporations like Gazprom and Rosneft and others. So there's vested interests here in Russia and Moscow who don't want detente with America at all. And, of course, there are vested interests in the other side of the ocean and in America that also don't want a bromance and a real detente with Russia. So I mean, I believe that any kind of attempts by, no matter if Putin and Trump may like each other or dislike each other, but if they try to kind of build a detente, there's going to be a lot of resistance, be an uphill struggle. And historically, such detentes will never end real good. The way the one in the reset that Obama began, the detente of 72, the Yalta Agreement of 45, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Munich in 38, they all ended real bad. Attempts to kind of detente between ideologically and politically opposing global forces don't work out.
Well, just in closing, though, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, the case that you're making of the choice between developing ties with the liberal faction as opposed to the conservative faction in Russia on the part of Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, that actually is a very good case for what Donald Trump is saying, that we need to improve relations, and anybody who doesn't want to get on better with Russia is a fool. The idea of both countries spending less on the military and de-emphasizing nuclear weapons would be a good thing for the planet, surely.
The vested interests opposed to that are so formidable. I mean, I'm not based in Washington, so I would not really try to guess what's going to be the American angle. But from our angle, I see that there's going to be lots of opposition. People will be saying that the Americans are just pulling our nose, that they should do more. That means Russia will be they will be demanding that America make more and more concessions until really the new Trump administration finds itself in an impossible position, that it's being misled, that the concessions are being made and Russia is not really behaving. And it's going to all go the way all detentes did before. So this is an uphill job. I don't really hope that it's going to happen.
Well, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is in Moscow, where he's a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and he worked for the Moscow Times for a number of years, and then became an independent defense analyst, and then joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the few independent media outlets left in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a Georgetown scholar who right-wing supporters of Trump are trying to have fired. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Bangladesh is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asia security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies, and her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And Christine, we've talked a lot about Afghanistan and also particularly your specialty, Pakistan, but you're making the news in a different way. In the Washington Post recently, there was an article, a Muslim woman who voted for Trump asked Georgetown to intervene over professor's hateful, vulgar messages, was the title of the article. And essentially, this woman, Azra Nomani, is trying to get you fired. She wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, "I'm a Muslim, a woman, and an immigrant, and I voted for Trump." So this is an unusual situation where essentially, is this a case then of an attack on academic freedom? What's going on here? Because I've relied on you for your expertise on South Asia, and it seems strange that you should be, somebody should be trying to basically silence you and put you out of business.
So I think there's a couple of issues. One, for the most part, and I'm not going to mention her name to give her more oxygen, actually fueled her. You know, this particular individual is very well connected to the most right wing of media. And so she has an inordinate ability to marshal some of the most abrasive vulgarians in our civil society. And the depiction of these events that has been published in these right-wing accounts is far from accurate. So let me tell you actually what did happen. And actually, you're the first person to actually carry my account of this. Even the Washington Post did not accurately reflect the sequence of events. On November 22, I wrote a series of tweets. They are all available in the Daily Caller. What's not reflected is the fact that, I mean, they only provided my tweets. In fact, this was an exchange back and forth. So she was able to curate the tweets to make it look as if this was simply a screed. But the important thing to note is that all of those comments were on one day, November 22. She did not report any discomfort to Georgetown until December the 3rd. And actually what had happened was that I had noticed that she had reached out to a scholar who was studying journalists and how they were treated when they attempted to cover the Trump campaign. Now, she did not tag me, and this was deliberate. What she had said to this scholar was that, one, she is a journalist, two, that she was covering the Trump campaign, and that, three, she had received hate speech from me. And she had included in this tweet to this scholar a redacted version of our direct messaging session, which is, of course, private. And she gave the impression that I had actually DM'd her out of the blue with this now notorious expression, FO and GTH. And when I saw this, I immediately tweeted to the professor, and I had, of course, tagged her, saying that, A, this is completely false, that the individual in question is not a journalist. She has not been a Wall Street. She has not had a Wall Street Journal byline in about a decade. Two, she was not covering the Trump campaign. She wrote an op-ed defending her vote for Trump. And three, I did not initiate this direct messaging. In fact, my direct message was in response to her messaging me in a message that was unwanted. I read her saccharine triacly a direct message to be akin to one of those messages an ex-boyfriend sends you saying that you want to be friends. And I was very clear that her contact was unwanted. Immediately upon my calling her out for this misrepresentation, she began tagging everyone at every possible organization at Georgetown. She would have, in fact, I think, tagged the cafeteria if she knew what the Georgetown dining hall IDs were. And immediately upon my calling her out for this misrepresentation to the scholar, she began not only tagging Georgetown, but she actually began writing to the head of the SFS faculty as well as the head of the Security Studies program. So what's actually interesting is that all of the subsequent tweets I had was actually defending myself against her effort to silence me by appealing to my employer. And so the Daily Caller gives the impression, in fact, they said explicitly that I went on a 31-day meltdown. The irony is it's actually her that went on a 31-day meltdown. She literally has harassed my employer since December 3 until today. It's really astonishing.
But hasn't this woman unleashed all of these right-wing pro-Trump trolls? And haven't you been harassed? And haven't the police had to come to your home? I mean, this is what...
Yes. Well, so, and of course, look, this anyone who knows this woman knows that this is her modus operandi. I am not the first, and I am not the last. She gives the impression that she is the victim here, but anyone who actually studies the evidence, I have not made any effort to silence her. And of course, being grown-ups here, no one can receive comments on Twitter that you don't want to read because there is this block function. I blocked her ages ago. To this date, she still has not blocked me. She lives on perpetual victimization. This is her sole job. Every controversy that she can generate and sustain is really her only way of making a livelihood. So the irony is that she is telling everyone that she is being bullied by me, which is completely preposterous. I, on the other hand, have received some incredibly vicious mail, one of which actually did merit a direct threat. It was actually pretty startling. The police did come to my home. This particular threat is being investigated. Most of the email that I've received are actually very clever in that they skirt the legal definition of something that's reportable. Some of the most vicious emails have said things like, you should go to a football field, put a gun in your mouth, and pull the trigger. Some of them, and so one of the things that the Daily Caller does, of course, is that they put in these so-called dog whistles. And one of the dog whistles that they put in, I'm actually very proud of. I am a proud vocal supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement. I am an ally of BLM, and I say this with pride. They obviously put that in there in hopes that some of the more violent and racist elements that would read the Daily Caller would email me. So the irony is that I have received emails from racists, from misogynists. Some of these people have actually emailed me from their employer's server. So if I wanted to reciprocate, I could actually report about 300 people to their employers. However, I don't play that way. It's actually been an interesting experience to get this kind of email, as well as phone calls, Facebook messages, people's pictures. I know a lot about the people that have sent me these vicious, rapacious, violent, racist, and misogynist messages, which I think really speaks to the degree to which, in this post-Trump environment, the most vicious elements of our society have been completely emboldened and empowered.
Well, I think our audience are probably wanting to know why this is a big issue. And I think it is a big issue because we are heading into this new environment, and that essentially a supporter of Trump who has made a big deal out of her being a Muslim woman who voted for Trump is trying to basically fire a scholar of the Middle East who has a very storied reputation. And the reason that I talk to you often as I can whenever Pakistan and Afghanistan is in the news is because of your expertise. You speak all the local languages, you've done your homework, you know what you're talking about. And my program is an attempt to have fact-based information. So now that we're heading into we have a president who doesn't care about facts, doesn't even believe in facts, and when he's told that Vladimir Putin helped elect him, he's denying it and blaming the Democratic National Committee for not protecting their servers, blaming the victim. We are entering a very surreal, fact-free world. So give me your sense of what the issues here and what's at stake.
Well, so first of all, people who simply maybe have seen the Daily Caller or the op-ed or watch this individual on Fox may not really appreciate who she is. In fact, we were professional social acquaintances some years ago. In fact, I had a falling out with her years ago. She has promoted some of the most hideous Islamophobic positions. For example, before congressional testimony, she actually said that women who wear hijab are on a trajectory of radicalization towards terrorism. She has absolutely excoriated Muslim women who wear hijab. Now, as a woman in general, I'm tired of being told what I should or should not wear. My Muslim friends who choose to wear hijab, they confront pressures from all directions. The last thing they need is this individual telling them that by choosing to wear hijab, they are on a radicalization path towards terrorism. She actually said this in congressional testimony. In 2010, she advocated profiling Muslims. And of course, she supports the registry of Muslims advocated by her presidential candidate of choice. So this is an individual who has positioned herself as the Islamophobe's favorite Muslim. She confirms for them all of their deep-seated fears about Muslims. And so well beyond her op-ed, I have had issues with her. Anyone who follows me on Twitter or as a Facebook friend knows, that I am an indefatigable supporter of religious freedoms, even though I am an atheist. I am an indefatigable fighter of Islamophobes on social media and elsewhere. So it is extremely ironic that an individual who has spent much of her last several years pandering to Islamophobes has filed a bias charge against me at Georgetown based upon the fact that she is a Muslim. So that's the larger context of who she is and how she is trying to situate herself. I have been concerned for some years, and you have known me for, my goodness, now 15 years. Ian, that's how long you and I go back. I have opposed both the left and the right's efforts to use personal speech to undermine people's employment. In other words, this creeping invasion of the nanny state. All of us who are not, you know, children of trust funds need our jobs. And so if people can appeal to our employers to silence speech, then essentially our First Amendment rights are vitiated. And so, to be honest, both the left and the right have done this. I have been assailed by people like Glenn Greenwald. He has organized a similar campaign because I dared question his lack of evidence for his anti-drone position in Pakistan. So I've been pilloried by both extreme elements on the right and the left, but the tactic is the same, to try to appeal to your employer to silence you. And if we don't fight back, our First Amendment right is absolutely vapid because we all need a job. And if our employers are going to assume that we represent them 24/7, then we essentially forego our rights to speech. And the First Amendment wasn't meant to protect polite speech. The First Amendment was intended to protect all speech except, obviously a speech which is intended to imminently incite.
Like crying fire in a crowded theater.
Exactly.
But in general, though, what I find extraordinary about this and what concerns me as we approach the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, given this extraordinary report that came out, it's unprecedented, the depth and nature of this intelligence report, which any normal person would be shamed into essentially resigning and saying, I'm sorry, I'm not a legitimate president, I was elected by a foreign enemy. But one of the things that is in that report is the use of Vladimir Putin's use of what they call troll farms, of unleashing Russian trolls. Now, this woman, because of her right-wing contacts and being a part of the right-wing, she's a perfect exemplar because she's a Muslim woman who voted for Trump. So they make the most of that and put her front and center, as they do with African-Americans, like the guy that's going to be the head of HUD, Housing and Development.
Mr. Carson, who actually said he wasn't.
He actually said what?
Well, you may recall that he said he wasn't qualified for that job.
Right.
He did run for president.
But
let's find humor where we can.
But the issue of trolls, I mean, they've essentially, the Trump people have unleashed these trolls on you, or she has, and this is a kind of echo chamber trying to get you fired, right?
So, I mean, there are a couple of things. So one, as you know, I am no wilting lily. I am certainly not a snowflake needing safe spaces. I mean, Pakistan's intelligence has threatened me, right? Routinely, when I write an op-ed advocating, for example, the United States should declare Pakistan to be a state sponsor of terror, you can see on the comments that I get on the op-ed or my YouTube videos or in emails that I get, incredibly obnoxious, violent, rapacious emails. A very common response will be, some army officer, you know, used you and tossed you away, and now you're angry. So in general, as a female in this space, I'm accustomed, it is so rare that someone writes me to say, you actually made a factual mistake. In fact, to be completely blunt, exactly once And that was very recently in a piece I wrote about the F-16 deal that's being offered to India. Has anyone ever written me to say, Dr. Fair, you made a mistake, and here's your factual mistake? In fact, I did make a factual error in that article. Almost all of the messages that I receive are deeply gendered. One of my favorites was, I think it was on Twitter, you need a Pakistani dick. And I wrote back to the fellow, well, apparently you do too. So, you know, what differs in this particular event is the scale. I have literally received hundreds of emails. I've received about 80 Facebook messages, about 10 or so voicemails. And then, of course, the comments on the Daily Caller piece number in the thousands. And these are generally deeply misogynist. They're often racist because of the wolf whistle or the dog whistle that the Daily Caller put in, noting the fact of which I'm proud that I'm a Black Lives Matter supporter. They also put in a dog whistle saying that I favor gun control. So the combination of misogyny, racism, and gun nuts have been truly overwhelming. And when a Pakistani writes such a note to me, I'm not actually afraid that something's going to happen to me because he lives in Pakistan. And by the way, it's almost always a he. But what makes these homegrown nutter emails all the more frightening is that this is actually in my country. Whereas the Glenn Greenwald sick trolls on me, generally liberals don't have guns. So this has really been a very, on the one hand, a very similar experience, but I'm actually far more afraid of these right-wing wing nuts because they actually do have weapons. And you know, as a female, the kinds of stuff I get in general are very different from the kinds of things that my males get. But on one occasion, I even had a strange man come to Georgetown looking for me, because I ignored his emails to me. So I think as a female in particular, the kinds of things that I face in general are much more severe than my male colleagues, but because of the nature of these harassers, I have to be much more careful and take these threats more seriously than I would the ordinary nastiness that I get from my Pakistani critics.
And your Pakistani critics include the ISI, the
intelligence agency,
who have murdered God knows how many members of their fellow citizens and have killed some of
them. And Americans.
And Americans.
Americans, right?
I mean, yeah, they killed.
Remember how many Americans they've killed through their proxies, the Taliban.
Right, and they killed colleagues of yours in Afghanistan.
Yep.
Well, I thank
Absolutely.
You for joining.
And countless Afghans.
I thank you very much for joining us. I wish you the best, and I hope that Georgetown shows some spine here. Thank you again, Chris.
Thank you so much, Ian, and for all of your years of support to me, and thank you for actually being one of the first people to actually ask me my side of the story. I'm really, really grateful to you and your listenership.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's in Bangladesh. She's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asia security issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes Podcast, and I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. They don't talk about the home of the brave and this land here under the free. One time, one night.